Welcome to the 4th Annual Danilo Husar-Struk Memorial Lecture. This lecture series was established in 1999, shortly after Danilo Struk's untimely death. The first lecture was delivered by Marko Paulishin in the year 2000. In the year 2001, our lecturer was Professor George Grabovich, and last year, the lecturer was Oleg Chmelnitsky from the University of Alberta. This lecture series honors Danilo Struk, a prominent Ukrainian scholar. He is no doubt best known in the community as the editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of Ukraine, a very substantial scholarly project that eventually appeared as a five-volume, very imposing set on every single one of your shelves, I am sure, and continues as a project in its preparation for an internet version, which is partially usable already, and work continues on it. But today, and in this lecture series in general, we honor Professor Struk's memory not so much as the editor of the encyclopedia, but as a scholar, as a teacher, as a translator of Ukrainian literature. This was Professor Struk's passion, and in that spirit, we founded this lecture series to preserve his enthusiasm for talking about Ukrainian literature, for teaching Ukrainian literature, and for presenting it in an English-speaking setting. Today's speaker is currently a member of the Slavic faculty at Columbia University, where he teaches Slavic and comparative literature, film, and gender studies. He was born in Odessa, in Ukraine, and received an education. The talent always rises to the available level, first in Moscow, and then as the level available rose, so did our speaker, and he ended up in the United States, where he received his PhD in comparative literature and literary theater and literary theory from the University of Pennsylvania. The topic of his dissertation, Towards a Soviet Postmodern, Paradigms of Post-Soviet Culture. His main research interests lie in contemporary literature and culture of Ukraine and other Slavic East European nations, as well as in the literature, literary theory, and cultural theory. He has published a great deal on these subjects, and he has translated a good deal of contemporary literature. He is the co-editor of an anthology of contemporary Russian poetry in English translation. He has articles on translations of Ukrainian, Russian, Polish, and the literature of former Yugoslavia. The title of his anthology is Crossing Centuries, and it appeared in the year 2000. And we are looking forward to his forthcoming book entitled Postmodernism, Postcolonialism, Postcommunism, A Global Cultural Transformation and Its Second World Manifestations. As you can see, our speaker is particularly interested in the new, the exotic, the unorthodox, the exciting. But I want to assure you that his values are all in the right place. And just to bring you an example of that, few literary scholars of Ukrainian literature are ever quoted in the New York Times. 2 years back, the New York Times honored our speaker with an essay in which he figured most prominently as the expert. The essay was on Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, and the question that the correspondent to the New York Times deemed most worthy of intellectual attention was whether Sacher-Masoch is Ukrainian or Russian. our distinguished speaker could assure the correspondent that Zakhar Mazok was in fact a Ukrainian, in fact claims himself to have been a Ukrainian and was born in Lviv, and so on and so on. But in order to get all of the accents right, our speaker explained that the Ukrainians have a claim to Zakhar Mazok that is legitimate, authentic, inevitable, that cannot be denied because he was a Ukrainian and was born in Lviv. Whereas the Russian claim to Zakhar Mazok is all in the intention, is all in the desire. And so Ukrainians are proud to have a son such as Zakhar Mazok, whereas the Russians just want to be masochists. With that spirit, and with our interest in things contemporary, I invite Professor Vitaly Chernetsky to give us his talk on Ukrainian literature in the age of globalization, how contemporary authors respond to the changing world.
Thank you so much, Professor Tarnovsky. Dear guests, thank you so much for coming here. It's a great pleasure and a great honor for me to be speaking to you today, and also that this is the Danilo Husov-Struk Memorial Lecture. I have very fond memories of Professor Struk as a wonderful colleague and a very nice human being, and perhaps an unusual sort of personal anecdote, if allowed, that Professor in July of 1998, Professor Struk and I had a chance to drink a Bruderschaft at the home of Professor Marko Pavlishin, who ended up being the presenter of the first Struk lecture. I also want to say in advance that I will begin with a visual epigraph, but ended up being too difficult to produce a transparency, so it will be very low tech. I have a printout on a computer of a scanned painting, which I will describe and then just pass around the printout so you can see what is the painting that I'm talking about. So without further ado, let me begin. And as I said, I begin with a visual epigraph. In the collection of the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, there is a painting by a contemporary Argentinian artist named Guillermo Kvitka, who is a grandson of immigrants from Ukraine. The painting, titled Odessa, consists of two images fusing into each other. The baby carriage rolling down the Potemkin steps in Eisenstein's famous film, perhaps the visual image of the city best known internationally, and the road map of the area of southwestern Ukraine around Odessa. Kvitka's painting could serve as a kind of epigraph for my reflections today. I would like to offer you an attempt to consider the cultural processes that occurred within the part of the world from which came both Kvitka's family and the images in this particular work in the period that embraces his career so far, that is the recent decades of the last 20 years of the 20th century. And similarly to much of Kvitka's recent work, I mean, I will invoke the metaphor of maps and mapping the salient features of this momentous cultural transformation that has been occurring on a worldwide scale and which has been associated with such words as postmodernism and globalization. And one would say that, you know, this time that we're living in right now is the case of the first large, you know, international cultural shift that indeed was able to sweep the entire planet. But as often happens, this is something that has begun in the West, and as a result, we've had a lot of global Western slippage, and there have been claims like that, quote, this whole global yet American postmodern culture is the internal and superstructural expression of a whole new wave of American military and economic domination throughout the world. U.S. is the last superpower, the heir to Europe's, you know, imperialist project, and this is how globalization proceeds as well. So what I would like to offer you, and what I think of many of my scholarly endeavors more generally, is a project of intervention into this intellectual sort of debate to try to make these people think of this part of the world that's sometimes called the second world, that is neither the first world, you know, the West and broadly speaking, nor the third world. Somehow there is always this, you know, oxymoronic binary. You oppose the first world to the third world, and, you know, if the second world is just forgotten. And so also deal with the fact that in the East Europe, in the former communist countries, these words are often just used as fashionable labels just to designate any contemporary literature and the arts without trying to seriously think what these terms might imply. And what I would like to argue is that, I mean, the globalization is not at all a unidirectional process where broadly global or narrowly American values are being spread around the world. It's very often, you know, it's these kind of statements as just a continuation of the West's sort of narcissism and, you know, attachment to, you know, its own idea of about being the embodiment of universal values, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Lots of people say that this is a bad thing, but, you know, they also participate in this kind of narcissistic discourse. While there have been people who have tried, especially this has come from the field of cultural anthropology, to say, wait a minute, this is we should not just be endlessly preoccupied, you know, in the West with thinking about these things without a positive or negative value judgments, that globalization is a historical, uneven process and localizing. I mean, different societies appropriate the ideas of modernity differently, and it's not all about just McDonald's, you know, triumphantly marching throughout the entire planet. I mean, it's a much subtler play of indigenous trajectories of desire and global flows of both people and things. And the painting that with which I began is a case in point. It's a product of global contact of cultures, but its cultural coordinates have little, if anything, to do with either the United States or the West conventionally understood. Rather, we have here a non-hierarchical encounter between Argentina and Ukraine, mediated by the history of immigration from the former Russian Empire, and we also have a product of hybridization of genres, painting, film, and cartography, and of ethnicities and cultures. Both Odessa and Buenos Aires are heterogeneous port cities settled by migrants. And so this idea of mapping is also something that some of the theorists of postmodernity and globalization have proposed. No, I have in mind in particular one of my teachers here in America, Professor Frederick Jameson, who is now at Duke University, and the idea that cognitive mapping is the most productive way of addressing this very variegated, heterogeneous cultural situation in which we find ourselves. And this approach will help us to deal with the various models and ideas of what globalization is culturally. And usually when people talk about globalization, they bring up two possible models. One is grounded more indeed in culture and cultural anthropology, and this is the one that says that, you know, we should be celebrating diversity and multiculturalism. We have, you know, whole bunch of identities of previously marginalized ethnic groups, and other identities, you know, race, gender, you know, sexuality, and so on and so forth, who are able to come into the public sphere and openly express themselves, and of the growth of popular democratization around the world. And on the other hand, we have the economist view of globalization that, wait a minute, no, it's not diversity, it's standardization. Everywhere around the world, you get the same Big Macs. I mean, no economy now can subsist independently. You're now all plugged into one large global machine from which you cannot escape. And, of course, the truth and the real situation lies somehow between the two points of view. Both the economic and the cultural have some degree of validity, but, you know, the troubles begin when they sort of start invading each other's territory. Let's just hope that out of this, tension, out of this standoff between these two approaches to thinking about globalization and what it brings, we can have some sort of productive flying of sparks and, you know, some sort of constructive debate. And what also happens is that with the situation, we are finally seeing an a rethinking of the so-called three worlds theory, first, second, and third world, which is the product of Cold War thinking clearly hierarchized. And unfortunately, what happened, because it was a theory that, you know, the model that arose in the West, because of the Iron Curtain, there was very little communication possible between the West and the Second World. So even when challenges to the Western centrism arose, usually this would be the strange oxymoronic thinking about First World versus Third World. And the Second World was only imagined as a sort of Archimedes point outside this sort of conflict, and as an abstract model, not as a real place where real people live and are engaged in, you know, daily survival, but also in creative activity. But more recently, people were sort of thinking, no, wait a minute, there is a thing that unites these worlds. I mean, it's the idea, the dream of utopian impulse, whether it's the idea that, you know, we're bringing the fruits of modernity and democratization, or we're bringing the idea of, you know, communism as universal happiness, however, delusional some of these ideas might be. And what has happened in recent years is that the utopian project, the big cultural sort of utopian impulse of the 20th century, was pronounced a failure in the former communist world and was purposefully abandoned in the West. And let us just hope that, you know, utopian thinking is not such a bad thing. And to have some sort of utopian impulse in approaching the world is, I think, a good and positive thing. And it's I think, much more clearly manifested in the ideas of cultures of resistance. I mean, because both within postmodernism, you two can have sort of a very outwardly celebratory attitude, whereas, you know, let's just, you know, happily indulge in, you know, McDonald's, Disney, and so on and so forth. And then there is a more critical approach, which is indeed trying to think of where we are in this complicated network, culturally and economically and otherwise. And now, finally, moving towards Ukraine as a case in point. Ukraine has been a very interesting case within the former communist world and within Slavic and East European, you know, world, more broadly speaking, by the fact that it was very much willing from the outset, you know, at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, to embrace some of this Western terminology talking about postmodernism and postcolonialism and globalization. But very often it happened is that, you know, these were just, you know, taken as fashionable labels, especially in the case of, say, postcolonial in adjectival form. And you could hear a lot in Ukraine about talking about postkoloniальна ментальність, постколоніальний стан, postcolonial mentality, postcolonial condition, without thinking what these things might mean. Now, fortunately, though, I think we are seeing the first steps towards a maturing of thinking about these things and of the place of Ukraine within this larger global context, because, you know, much of the initial euphoria of the time of independence has given way to sort of the more sober and sometimes somber reflections as to what is the place of Ukraine in the world, how much attention is being paid to Ukraine, and so on and so forth. And So an example of this sort of maturation of discourse that I would like to propose at first is an essay by one of the leading contemporary Ukrainian writers, Yuri Andrukhovich, which was initially published in 1999. This was an essay called «Час і місце або моя остання територія» – «Time and Place or My Last Territory». And this was an essay which was, you know, specifically commissioned for a conference on postmodernism, which was to take place in Lviv. And the way Andrukhovich approached it was just to start with an idea of, you know, this merits of carnivalesque presentation of all the stereotypical views of what postmodernism is as irresponsible, parasitic, death of original culture, of vulgar tastelessness, and so on and so forth. And what he did, he just arranged these stereotypes alphabetically, from A to Ya, you know, all the, you know, letters of Cyrillic alphabet, even though sometimes he, you know, threw in words from other languages because the entry for the letter U was Yuzhnyevem Yakishche. But from that, he moves to the more serious part because the only way he feels this flood of stereotypes can be dealt with is through personal, subjective features and cultural signifiers, through asking the question, where am I? In other words, he arrives at this very paradigm of cognitive mapping that I have mentioned a few minutes ago. In his case, this leads to a reflection on the cultural composition of his native region of Ukraine, Galicia, paradoxically located in the center of Europe geographically and at its margins culturally. And Central Europe, in and of itself, despite its name, has been an almost of invisible sort of marginalized presence in much of the Western literary, cultural, and intellectual discourse. So Central Europe as such, as a presence, almost doesn't exist. And within Central Europe, conventionally thought, Galicia almost does not exist either, even though it's very much part of it geographically. But Andruchowicz tries to address this in productive fashion. So this particular territory allows one to approach postmodernity as the great promising void and emptiness of rubble following the crumbling or active destruction of various modernities and modernisms. We have an ambivalent situation where we have the emergence of a post-totalitarian condition, but also the continuing sort of neo-totalitarian threat. On the other hand, there also is the need to think about traditions of multiculturalism, because Galicia historically has been one of the most ethnically, religiously, and culturally heterogeneous regions of Europe. Witness a character like Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, whom Maxim has mentioned in his introduction. However, this multiculturalism has been nearly obliterated through the history of wars of the 20th century. So now, in fact, we have, as it were, a post-multiculturalism manifested through ruins. There are a lot of ruins to be found, ruins of castles, ruins of holy places, ruins of factories, of bridges, of observatories, and especially of old cemeteries. A palimpsest of cultures and anti-cultures, as it were, and fragments of lost languages, writing systems, dialects, and burnt manuscripts. These are all lists that come from Andruchowicz. As some of you may know, he is a big master of a list as an artistic device. And he always, in each and every text of his, there'll be a very flamboyant and, you know, fascinating listing of things. So the task of a postmodernist practitioner of culture, asserts Andruchowicz, is to address the particular location where he or she finds him or herself today. This may be a dangerous territory, yet there is no choice but to address it. And this, I think, is one of the key elements of what a Ukrainian engagement with these larger global phenomena like postmodernism, postcolonialism, and globalization are. And, of course, in the case of Ukraine, this is particularly exacerbated by the difficult history of Ukraine. I mean, no country in the world has had an easy history, but I think Ukraine can certainly take a prize of one of the places with, you know, the most dramatic and tormented historical events, and, you know, in the past 100 years in particular. And so, especially if we talk about, you know, the liberalization and opening up of the final years of so-called perestroika and the final arrival of independence, we had, you know, two big, you know, communist crackdowns in the 1930s and the 1970s, we had the famine, we had the impact of the war, and also, which perhaps was even more pernicious, the active propagandizing of, by the official channels, the idea of Ukrainian culture as second-rate, mediocre, stereotypical, reduced to folk dancing, you know, borscht and dumplings, and only, you know, the publication of the worst, the most, you know, conformist of writing, which was officially sanctioned in Soviet times, and then, of course, the trauma of Chernobyl. So the liberalization of the late 80s, early 90s came to a Ukrainian people who was unsure of its cultural affinities and felt stigmatized for its own culture and language. But this is a situation which is quite similar to a situation in which a lot of countries of the former colonies of various empires have found themselves with at the time of independence. For many of them, it is the idea of, slow and hard and traumatic with many fits and starts, building of a new culture that has been one of the big paramount projects of the post-independence years. So I think if there are parallels to cultural situations and developments here, these would be with the former colonies. And so the idea is that, colonialism is obviously a nasty thing, but how does one fight colonialism? One can merely sort of replicate the same value judgments, but just reverse the positive and negative attachments, the signs. But the more productive approach would be indeed to somehow rise above the binaries and think about the situation more sort of critically, and try to indicate sort of its impact on the human psyche and to see how we sort of deal with these. So to have some sort of reparative, therapeutic project, which is combined with the cultural analysis. And I think, and this opinion has been shared by other, critics of Ukrainian literature and culture, that we have in Ukraine quite many sort of talented writers and other artists who participate in these things. The names that are often mentioned, for instance, would be those of Valery Shevchuk as the leader of sort of the magic realist movement in Ukrainian writing, the writers that comprise the famous Bubabu group, that is Yurian Drukhovich, Viktor Neborak, and Alexander Irvanets, the new women's writing, first and foremost, the work of Oksana Zabushko, and several others. And I will talk about these writers in a few minutes. But before I do that, I would like to propose one more, little theoretical element. When theories of, try to generalize what is it that different with the cultures of former colonies as opposed to Western cultural production, one of the important, if, sort of controversial and debated proposals was by Frederick Jameson, whose name I mentioned a few minutes ago. That is the concept of national allegory. While for Western cultures, the Western literatures in particular, has been argued that there is a radical split between the private and the public, between the poetic and the political, between what we have come to think of as the domain of sexuality and the unconscious and that of the public world, in the cultures of former colonies, even those texts which seem to be dealing with properly private, libidinal issues necessarily project a political dimension in the form of national allegory. The story of a private individual destiny is always an allegory of the embattled situation of the public culture and society, whether there is an overt allegorical element in how the text is constructed or not. So we have sort of a right to read any of such texts as a potential allegory for the cultural situation of the nation in question. And if one looks at the some of what I hope are the productive ways of dealing with the situation, I would say there are three sort of large camps that I've identified. One is can broadly be grouped with the notion of magic realism, which deals with a lot of a spatio-temporal convolution of the narrative, and the fusion of the magic and the mundane. And the three writers that I will mention briefly in this respect and about whom I will comment would be Valery Shevchuk, Yuri Vinichuk, and Oles Ulyanenko. Then there was this carnivalesque outburst of, daring engagement in all sorts of transgressive practices, both verbally and thematically, and, associated with the notion of the carnival and its reverberation in local Ukrainian context. And this is the poetry and the public performance of the Bubabu writers, Andruhovich, Neborak, and Irvanets. And following that comes, as it were, the post-carnivalesque attempt to rethink and reflect on these things, which comes, you know, in the work of both Andruhovich and recently Irvanets with his dystopian novel Rivne Rovno, and also this new women's writing where there is a big focus on gender and corporeal issues. And once I would, you know, mention Oksana Zabushko as the leading practitioner, but there are also many others. For instance, Evgenia Kononenko, Halina Polutyak, Svetlana Pirkova, and many others. So, first of them, magic realism. Magic or magical realism is a term that actually originated in 1920s in Germany and an application to visual arts, not to literature. But it became best known and popularized in the context of Latin America, as some of you may know, in the 1950s and the 1960s. And why magic realism has become prominent is that it is a genre which is really well suited to exploring and transgressing boundaries, whether these boundaries are ontological, political, geographic, or generic. The magic realism facilitates the possibility of fusing or coexistence of many possible worlds, spaces, and, you know, cultural systems that would be otherwise irreconcilable in other types of fiction. And the important thing for understanding what magic realism is that it's not a realism to be transformed by a supplement of some sort of magical perspective, but a vision of a reality which is in and of itself magical or fantastic. This was the key idea, one of the fathers of, you know, the notion of magic realism, Cuban writer Alejo Carpentier. He talked about lo real maravilloso, the marvelous magical reality. We have to see that. And for magic realism, a very important issue is the question of history, but it's a history with holes, perforated history, where hallucinatory scenes and events, fantastic and phantasmagoric characters are used to rethink our thinking of the historic past. History is no longer chronicle, but as it were, clairvoyance. And if there is one stylistic and historical period that has been a particular fascination for magic realist writers, this has been the era of the Baroque. And the Baroque is also connected with the idea of allegory, and which is something which is quite apt and appropriate for the case of Ukraine, because for Ukraine, too, it has been asserted that the Baroque era has been one of the major times of flowering of Ukrainian culture. Many writers have asserted the Baroqueness as one of the essential traits of, you know, Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian psyche. To quote Andruhovich again, Ukraina ж це країна бароко. So let us hope that there is indeed a critical power that stems from such a position. And as I said, if there are two dominants of stylistic laws of the Baroque, is the fascination with allegory and with ruins and strange deformation of forms. And this era, which for Ukraine also is the Cossack era, the time of, you know, the independence, you know, of the Cossack state, the Hetmanate, and is indeed a very prominent part of the national history and culture. This is a time that has continued to fascinate Ukrainian cultural practitioners, you know, beginning with a new modern revival, starting with Ivan Kotlarevsky, and to perhaps a writer of Ukrainian origin who is one of perhaps best known internationally. I have in mind, of course, Mykola Gogol, a.k.a. Nikolai Gogol. And his impact makes for a very strong argument for, you know, the prominence of magic realism for Ukraine, because all the Western critics and theoreticians who write about magic realism always trace it back to Gogol as the founding father, as it were, for them, of this type of writing. And so when in the more recent times in Ukraine there arose a genre which can be classified as a local, national version of magic realist writing, this is the genre which was called chimerna prosa, or chimeric or whimsical prose, and it arose virtually independently with Latin American magic realist writing, simultaneously but independently. And it's the first text identified as such usually is a 1958 novel by Alexander Ilchenko called козацькому роду нема переводу, або ж мама і чужа молодиця. And this has become a very prominent genre of Ukrainian literature, which was grudgingly tolerated by the authorities and allowed to develop as long as its aesthetic deviation did not spill into thematic transgression. When that happened, tolerance evaporated quickly and people would be arrested or prohibited from publishing, as the case might be. But what was the big problem of this, you know, officially sanctioned magical realist writing? It was seen as sort of a Soviet idea of narodnost, or popular spirit, so it was basically seen as the Ukrainian equivalent to Russian village prose, and it was allowed elements of fantasy and laughter, but it had still stayed within the general sort of teleological orientation of socialist literature, but, you know, somehow I tried to grasp the national character. But the big problem with it is that this was a literature which was almost universally humorous or sarcastic in tone, and thus it ended up reinforcing the worst colonial stereotypes about Ukrainian culture. Ilchin Kosmozatsmo Rodo Nema Perevodo is a case in point, or as a later famous text like Yevhen Hutsovo's Position in Cholovik, The Borrowed Husband, published in 1981. And so it's not so much Kotlarevsky himself that they imitated as Kotarevshchina, the epigonist, you know, following of these things. And so they towed the official party line on Russian-Ukrainian friendship and, you know, end up being so very crude. Basically, you know, funny, you know, collective farmers, you know, dealing with, you know, witches and, you know, things of that kind. And so that's really not the kind of writing to be proud of. But what happened that there did arise a more serious, so some of the more productive form of magic realism, and its appearance has been associated with its beginning with the work of Valery Shevchuk, who started out in the 1960s as a realist writer of the non-socialist variety, but in the late 1960s tried to shift indeed to these sort of magical realist writing, but he dispensed with this crude humor that was found in this Chimerna prosa and challenged its underlying cultural and political assumption. What, of course, happened is that he was prevented from publishing these things, and so he was absent from print in Ukraine for about a dozen years. And I will talk briefly about possibly his most famous novel called Tri listki za viknom, Three Leaves Outside the Window, which was published in 1986. And similarly to the sort of the more mainstream, you know, chimeric prose, intertextual dialogue with Gogol is unavoidable for Shevchuk, but it assumes a very different dimensions. He set at his goal, as he declared as early as the 1970s, створити анти-Гоголя, to create an anti-Gogol, as it were, because, I mean, he was profoundly disturbed with all the elements of so-called malorussiistvo in Gogol's writing, that is, the presentation of Ukrainian mentality as something exotic and to be mocked, destined for the consumption by the imperial center. What Shevchuk strove for, it was to recreate, as unprejudicedly as possible, the psychology and ontology of pre-modern Ukrainian culture. So, indeed, he went back to the period of, you know, Ukraine's difference and independence from Russia. That is indeed the, you know, late Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and the Baroque. This particular novel, Three Leaves Outside the Window, is a vision of three centuries of Ukrainian history. It's a grand, epic text. It's organized as the three first-person narratives by members of one Ukrainian family. All three are sort of traditional lonely intellectuals striving to know the world. The figure of, you know, the great Ukrainian philosopher and poet Grigory Skovoroda is of paramount importance for Shevchuk, and there are a lot of reverberation of Skovoroda in his writing. So, in the 17th century, and this quest is for an extratemporal moral truth. In the 18th, it's a quest for a documented, verifiable truth, so the Baroque, the Enlightenment, and in the 19th century, the search is not so much for the truth, but for more and more confirmations that we live in a very depraved and fallen world. So the naturalist or realist approach of the mid-19th century. But the text is primarily preoccupied not so much with epistemologies of the science of knowing as with ontology, the reflection about a being and the character's experience, says, indeed emerge as allegory for Ukrainians' psychic and intellectual involvement over these three centuries, the 17th, the 18th, and the 19th. The occupations of the characters are also indicative. In the 17th century, Ilya Turchinovsky is a son of a Cossack who studies at the Kiev Bohil Academy and eventually becomes a priest. In the 18th, Petro Turchinovsky, also a former student of the Kiev Mohyla Academy, is a legal clerk. In the 19th century, Kiryak Avtonomovich Satanovsky, after graduating from Kiev University, becomes a gymnasia teacher. Their yearnings and aspirations diminish in scale, while their conformity to the ruling order increases. So some critics, like, say, Marko Pavlyushin, present it as the Spenglerian vision of the decline of the Ukrainian culture and spirit. But I think that this is actually more of a Baroque construction, and indeed the idea of the ruin, ruina, which is also a very familiar concept for Ukrainian culture. So it has been argued that in Baroque literature, when history enters the picture, it is a picture of mourning, of sadness, and history is present in the form of ruin, of which history is not a process of eternal life so much as that of irresistible decay. And the allegory thereby declares itself to be beyond beauty. Allegories are, as Walter Benjamin has said, in the realm of thoughts, what ruins are in the realm of things. And this explains the Baroque cult of the ruin. And this novel, Three Leaves Outside the Window, really is, in a way, this kind of work of mourning in its persistent interest in this kind of clashes of nature and history, good and evil, the spiritual and the material, and their eternal interdependence. But rather than offering the reader an abstract symbolism, the argument develops allegorically. Shevchuk, of course, is at his most Baroque in the part set in the 17th century, where, you know, Ilya Turchinovsky experienced a lot of frightening events, but somehow persistently strives for spiritual goodness. And his is an optimistic outlook. And for Baroque, the idea is that optimism is based on the infinity of the damned. But we have fallen so low, we're so far down at the bottom, that it liberates an infinite quality of possible progress. So we can only move up. And the personal suffering is how an individual, a monad in Leibniz's Storm, impresses itself on the world. I mean, that's the only way that we can deal. And Ilya Turchinovsky actually does reach inner peace, and he has a coherent worldview. The second part of the story of Petro Turchinovsky is, on the contrary, a story of unraveling and crisis. He is an Enlightenment man who believes in verifiable, documented vision, and he is a legal clerk by profession. However, in Ukraine, the Enlightenment never fully reigned and challenged in the 18th century, so he encounters the Baroque and is subverted by it and actually is unraveled, and he disappears into the unknown. The darkest part, the 19th century, is the story of psychic degradation affected by colonial servitude. I mean, the protagonist even changed his last name from Sotanovsky to Satanovsky to adapt it to Velikoruskoye Proiznoshenie, the Russian pronunciation. And he sees himself as a tool of the empire to produce uniform and perfectly functioning cogs and wheels for the great state machine, and he admiringly compares himself that he strives to become an automaton, a mechanical doll. And he wants to systemize and classify how awful the world around us is. He has a black book where he writes all these things down, but what happens? He falls in love. So he too suffers a crisis. It turns out that he is such an evil person that being in love with him kills other people. So two people that he falls in love both die. But at the end, he too undergoes a personal crisis, and he perishes in a fire that engulfs his building. Fire is an element which is on the one hand infernal, on the other potentially liberating. Also, this happens at the time of the Cyrilo-Methodian Brotherhood. So in a way, this is once again, so at the end, the ritual burning of the old, unchallenged, thinking of, Ukrainian intellectuals, and the beginning of the national liberation. So that's what happens to Satanovsky. So by such allegorical means, the magic realism, especially of this psychological introspective strain dominated by Shevchuk, tries to both represent and simultaneously subvert the legacies of colonialism and totalitarianism in contemporary Ukraine, and both in the national psychic trauma and an ontological crisis. And despite the melancholy outlook, there is always of the intellectual idea of liberation. And there is also a different strain of magic realism, which also contains a lot of violence and more transgressive stuff, and that's the writing of both Yuri Vinichuk and Oves Ulyanenko. Vinichuk likes little parable stories, but, you know, they're often quite scary, like the story in the Snail Chronicle, Litopis Hidravlaka, where humans are invaded by snails and end up being turned into snails because snails oppress them. Or the story Laskava Porosoma Shurohrad, Welcome to Ratville, where there are mutant rats who develop human consciousness, which also invade humans and, you know, basically colonize them. But Vinichuk just likes to overstuff his text with physical and verbal transgression to sort of exorcise anything associated with the colonial mentality. He also likes the idea of sex, and I will mention that, you know, in a few minutes, because that is something actually strange and disturbing as to where he goes in that direction. And then finally, Oves Ulyanenko, the youngest of these you know, magic realists, born in 1962, his writing is dominated by sort of very bleak and somber mood, but he also perhaps has the most exotic biography of contemporary Ukrainian writers, because his biography includes army service in Afghanistan, a stint as a patient of a mental hospital, and living homeless on the streets of Kyiv for several years. His breakthrough success came in 1994 with the publication of his novel Stalinka, and he was still technically homeless when he was awarded the state's highest honor, the Shevchenko Prize, and as a part of a prize, he received a studio apartment in the Kharkivsky Massif in one of the new developments in Kyiv. His favorite mode of writing is stream of consciousness, and he is considered the leading Ukrainian representative of the so-called Chornuha, sort of the gory, sort of the guts and gore of, you know, contemporary writing. And Stalinka, this is his most famous text, is very short, only 96 pages in the book edition. But it's a very slow and dense narrative, which, you know, writes in this Faulknerian page-long convoluted sentences. It consists of two alternating and gradually converging narratives. One of them is a story of a character who escapes from a small-town mental hospital, decides to take a new name, Iona, and makes his way to Kyiv, where he lives as a strange, quasi-holy fool figure. The second is the story of a certain Gorik Piskaryov, a.k.a. Grigory Piskurenko, nicknamed Wolf, the last of the Piskurenko-Piskaryov clan, who is a leader of a street gang that fights the rival gang's control of the Kyiv neighborhood known as Stalinka, you know, buildings built during the late 40s, 1950s. Shortly before Gorik's death, he meets Jonah, and the latter briefly becomes his spiritual advisor and confessor. While in the Jonah story is a somewhat bizarre combination of autobiographical elements and the retelling of the Bible's book of Jonah, and to show you how, you know, highly Ulyanenko thinks of himself, you know, I'm a biblical prophet. It is the story of the Piskaryov, you know, clan that emerges as a powerful, condensed, allegorical representation of totalitarianism, Stalinist civilization, and how it impacted Ukraine. We can argue that it's sort of a neo-naturalist of Emile Zola-style story of one family's progressive degeneration. But it is complicated by the stream of consciousness narrative, and indeed a very wide, you know, use of the magical things, of where there's a lot of hallucinations. I mean, they all drink a lot, so they end up, you know, hallucinating wild and strange things. And so the text goes fully into the magic realist paradigm. And like other magic realist texts, its world is a closed microcosm. This is the case for all Shevchuk's and Vinichuk's writing. This is also the case for Ulyanenko. It's a sealed-off world, and it's entirely located on Ukrainian territory, which turns out to be no less Stalinized as the rest of the Soviet Union, and it's the Gorik's grandfather, fully Ukrainian by ethnicity, that in the text makes the fatal alliance with the Stalinist state machinery. He is a proud, unrepentant, trigger-happy ex-NKVD operative whose career began in 1929 and skyrocketed in 1933. Grandfather worships Stalin and is very much proud in his deeds and the blood of his many victims, and hates obsessively Khrushchev because of his de-Stalinizing policies. He delights in recalling his participation in killings and torture back in the glory days. Gorik's father is an alcoholic, a non-entity dominated by his father and his wife. His first offspring is a retarded boy nicknamed Sio-Sio, who eventually strangles the family's last living tie with the authentic pre-Stalin culture, the grandmother, and sets the family apartment on fire. Gorik himself is as much of a child of the mean streets, mentored by an aging ex-con and hardened in gang violence, yet in the family situation it is indeed the primary impulse that sets him on his doomed path. His death is gruesome and horrifying, but seems pre-programmed by his biography and his heredity. The book is generally shot through with apocalyptic overtones, and it is very much overtly meant to be an allegory for the Ukrainian experience. Even the Jonah of the novel is a disillusioned prophet, so even the very qualified optimism that we find in some other works is entirely absent in this text. Ulyanenko and the other writers he feels close to envision their project as what they call constructive mythologization, and they actually consider themselves anti-postmodernists in terms of ideology, and they're very much, you know, against and personally dislike people like Andruhovich and other contemporary Ukrainian writers, but their constructiveness is of a fairly reactionary kind. I mean, they have basically, they compare the Soviet Union to pagan Rome, and they believe that there will be some sort of new strict Christianity that will arise and impose its order on Ukraine. I don't see that happening, but all in all, I mean, one has to grant Ulyanenko his power as a stylist, because the visions, the apocalyptic visions of contemporary Ukraine that he conjures, do in fact give people nightmares, and it is very powerfully written. But to move to the more cheerful part, the carnivalesque and post-carnivalesque writing. What happens is that if in the magic realism we have sealed-off microcosms, in the works of the carnivalesque trend are conversely very much open, fluid in structure, heterogeneous in their intertextual links, and overall sort of exuberant in their form. They are marked by a suspense or radical distortion of traditional narrative temporality and of a conscious investment of various modes of joyful carnivalesque transgression. They very much like to be playful in their textual approach, and this way, through the playfulness, they try to critique both the Russian and Soviet imperialist oppression, but also the fossilized traditional forms of national iconography. So, I mean, this revolutionary upheaval was first and foremost associated with the arrival on the Ukrainian literary scene in the late 1980s of the trio of writers then primarily known as poets, who call themselves Bubabu, which stands for Burlesque Balahan Bufonada, Yuri Andruhovich, Alexander Ivanets, and Viktor Neborak. Bubabu was formed in 85, gave its first public reading in 87, and the peak of its activity falls on the years 88-92, and it was the Poeza opera, poetry opera called Kreislar Imperial, staged in Lviv in 1992 as a part of the Vivek Festival that has been designated as the apotheosis of the movement. All three writers are still culturally active, but they seem to have put this part of their biography behind them. Neborak has become an academic. Ivanets is a playwright and more recently also wrote this dystopian novel, Rivne Rovno. And for Andruhovich, the experience of Bubabu became one of the major themes for his reflection and reconsideration in his prose writings of the 90s and into the 2000s, first decade of the 21st century. One of the main distinguishing features of Bubabu is the focus on public performance and community creation, which is, I think, is unprecedented in Ukrainian letters. To my knowledge, Bubabu is the only literary group or movement anywhere in the world to acknowledge the writing of Bakhtin as a major source of inspiration and artistic practice, although they insist that they arrived at their ideas prior to reading this philosopher. And without minimizing the crucial differences between the individual writers, one can say that their texts from the late 80s, early 90s do come across as a sort of amalgam. And one of the examples would be a poem by Oleksandr Irvanets called Turbatsiya Mas, Hymn Oda Bubabu. The Stirring of the Masses, a hymn or ode to Bubabu, the very title of which incorporates a carnivalesque pun. Turbatsiya Mas, the stirring of the masses, versus Mas Turbatsiya, masturbation. This parodic ode to the group, for all of its cheerful subversive tone, nevertheless contains a strong message of community. Vas navkolo sebe budem gurtuvati, chas ne tantsuvati i ne morduvati, masy turbuvati. Masy turbuvati. We shall gather you in a group next to us. It's time neither to dance nor to beat people up, but to stir the masses. I mean, yet their project is not a return to avant-garde writing of, say, the futurists like Semenko or others, because it's for them, indeed, it's not just being a challenge, but being indeed part of a public action, a performance read aloud and bursting with voices, and try to, I mean, they don't try in the way, say, Semenko's Ukrainian futurism did to complete or turn upside down the Ukrainian literary tradition. They don't try to burn Kobzaro or engage of any practices of the kind. What they not a retrospective apocalypse. On the contrary, they play with the gaps and taboos of national culture. Both repentance and insult are just completely mixed up and melted together into laughter, which has taken by Bubabu to be the only possibility of avoiding the fully prostituted official Soviet-style culture. Yet they yearn for mass action and resonance, which suggests once again their kinship with the carnivalesque. But exuberance and transgression of taboos often generate considerable controversy. For instance, Irvanets authored a series of poems dated 1992, which mocked the kitsch incarnation of the national narrative as it was emerging in the first months of independence. For instance, the poem called Eine kleine Nachtmusik, subtitled a lullaby ode to the mother nation, opens with the lines, Від Дону до Сяну лежиш осіянна, від Тигра з Ефратом лежиш аж до Осло і Баранович. From the Don to the Sian you lie, or the Radiant One, from the Tigris and the Euphrates, all the way to Oslo and Baranovich. So it tries to mock this sort of national euphoria, resurrecting, you know, the idea of the claim to a larger Ukrainian territory. After all, both the Don and the Sian now are mostly outside Ukraine's borders. But what he does, he stretches Ukraine all the way to Mesopotamia and Norway. Another famous poem by him called Lubit, better known as Lubit Oklahoma, Love Oklahoma, parodies the, you know, the patriotic 1940s poem by Soviet Ukrainian writer Volodymyr Sosyura, Lubit Ukrainu. So the transforming, you know, it also has a lot of carnivalesque puns and even mention of female genitalia. Similarly, Viktor Nebarak, in his Pisenka pro Lyalyu Bo, a ditty about Lyalya Bo, continues the new transcends alliterative experimentation, which is parodically presented as the glorious affirmation of the national sentiment, as exemplified in the following stanza. В Лялі Бо є права і обо, і великі цебе, і маленькі бобо. Цоб цебе, цяця киця ми цебе, бо мета в Лялі Бо українська. Lyalya Bo has rights and duties, and the big tsabe and the little bobo, tsop tsabe, kuchi kitimeti be, for Lyalya Bo's goal is Ukrainian. In this poem, withered fragments of official discourse on the rights and duties of a citizen in this particular stanza are mixed with a quasi-childish babble, only to lead, seemingly out of nowhere, to patriotic slogans of the final lines of each stanza. The head, the trumpet, the goal, and the soul of the mysterious Lyalya Bo are proclaimed to be Ukrainian. So Andruhovich, of the three of the Bubabu writers, from the very beginning, embarked on the more reflexive, exploratory course of the trying to think of through the hybrid space of Ukraine. What, his early short story, Samilo's Namirova Prekrasny Rozbishaka, Samilo of Nemery, the Handsome Robber, would be a good example of this kind.
It is a text of which, in overt theme, follows a kind of paradigm that was made famous by the Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges.
In his short story collection, The Universal History of Infamy, quasi-documentary stories of supposed real characters that become various of wild and crazy and fantastic, and the characters are not famous people, but emphatically marginal. So when Andruchowicz tries to do an exercise in this paradigm, he, of course, chooses the golden age of the early 17th century. But his take on the era is strikingly different from, say, Shevchuk's, you know, Baroque microcosms. There's none of Shevchuk's serious, terrifying mood. We have instead an exuberant, carnivalesque adventure. And before engaging my adventure, how am I doing on time? I'll wrap up. Okay. Well, the story of this adventure is basically we have this guy, a gangster, who terrorizes Lviv in the 16 teens, and they do all sorts of extravagant and crazy things. But then it turns out, suddenly in the text, that they have characters calling each other on the telephone. There is this wild circus animals who are set loose and just run into downtown. They proceed down Lenin Street, and you know they use tear gas and things of that kind. So basically, this becomes a sort of nonsensical postmodernist fusion of things. But then it leads to a serious reflection. Nemirich had to drink to bottom the bitter cup of the tragedy of all great people, writes Andruchowicz, the incongruity with the time into which they were thrown by Providence. But the bitterness of Nemirich's cup is of a double nature, not only the time, but also the place. For he had a misfortune of being a Ukrainian and living in Ukraine, devoid of its own statehood, jurisprudence, its own history, finally of its own criminal world. In America, he could have become a president, in Rome, a pope, or at least a cardinal. In England, he could have been Robin Hood, in Germany, perhaps Bismarck, but in Ukraine, he could only become a gangster. So this becomes not only a mocking gesture, but also a much more serious text. Then, if we look at the progression of Andruchowicz's writing in his novels, he tries to see the state of Ukrainian intellectuals and how they react to the global condition. This first novel, Rekreatsii, we have this carnivalesque confusion, many different points of view, and it's a displacement within Ukraine's borders. His second novel, Moskoviada, is a displacement to the center of the empire, and it's only to see the empire collapse, but this collapse presented from the defamiliarizing outsider point of view that allows us to, you know, see a very powerful critical statement of the evils of Soviet colonialism, among other things. His third novel, Perversia, is a displacement of Ukrainian intellectuals outside Ukraine. Most of the text takes place in Germany and then in Venice. And so it's now a Ukrainian creative intellectual encountering the larger world, the larger global condition. And finally, his latest novel, 12 ritualnych obruchy, 12 ritual hoops, which are two fragments from which have been published and which will be coming out in book form in September, takes the West to Ukraine. We have one of the main characters who is an Austrian named Karl Josef Zumbrunnen, who comes to Halychyna with a quest of finding something real, and of course dies there, fulfilling a prophecy that a fish from the Danube will come upstream to the Carpathian Mountains. Of course, it's much more complicated than that, but you know, you can see sort of a clear progression. Sadly, from a very, you know, carnivalesque and exuberant Rekreatsii, and the Andruchowicz's mood turns darker and darker, but there are always a little bit of ray of light in his writing. And a similar kind of thing would also be observable in the writing of Oksana Zabushko, where, as I said, you know, one of the major additions thrown in is the focus on the corporeal and sort of the challenge to the traditional male heterosexual triumphalism, which we unfortunately find in so much of mainstream Ukrainian writing. So one of the crucial things that is usually seen as the main thing, the main necessity for the new literature of the former colonized nations is not so much critique and subvert, but to do what a wonderful, you know, Caribbean, French Caribbean writer M. Césaire called the invention of new souls, when you produce new kind of people. And it is in the undying energy and the persistence in this project that I see in the work of Ukraine's best contemporary intellectuals and some of the writers whom I mentioned, Yuri Andrukhovich and Oksana Zabushko in particular, that I see this kind of spirit being present. It amazes me that they do not abandon this project even in the very difficult times that Ukraine has experienced since reaching its independence, as Yuri Andrukhovich has mentioned in his speech to the PEN Congress in Warsaw in 1999, Ukrainian independence arrived with the bitter taste of the apocalyptic, as it was precipitated by the Chernobyl catastrophe and followed by the years of economic and cultural chaos, where, to quote Andrukhovich again, the former prison became Bazar Vokzal, a flea market by the train station. But despite all this, the intellectual must continue his or her project, even though without thinking necessarily that there is a chance to be heard. You have to persist in what you believe is your duty. You're right because you cannot not write. And I hope that indeed out of this new souls will spring up in the newly free Ukraine, and contemporary Ukrainian literature, I think, makes a very powerful and invaluable contribution to this project. Thank you very much for your attention.